Good morning and welcome to session 112, the liberal case for the liberal Mormon case for large families. This paper will be presented by Christopher Bradford, who is a software architect and founding member of the Mormon Transhumanist Association and has a BA in linguistics from BYU. Please be sure that your cell phones and pagers and other noise-making things are turned off. And at the end, when we get to the question and answer session, please use this microphone, which I'll move into the aisle so that your voice will be captured on the recording. And with that, I will turn the time over to Christopher.
Thanks, Christine. So, I have no degree in family relations. I have no training in lies, damned lies, or statistics. So what makes me qualified to speak on this topic? Well, according to some people, I am certifiably insane, having six children under the age of 12. My close friends agree that I should be considered a liberal Mormon. So I guess at least I fit the title of this talk. In addition, my mother informs me that I am personally responsible for dramatically curtailing the size of the family that I grew up in. Before she had children, she wanted 10, and then she had me, and she decided that 5 would be plenty. So I grew up as the oldest in a family with 5 children, which in my generation was probably fairly average. My father was one of 9 children, which I think was even large in his generation. My mother was one of 5 in her generation. My wife comes from a very large family. Her mother had 11 children. Then my wife's father passed away, and her mother remarried a man who brought 6 more children into the family with him. So they had a family with 17 children. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago now, my wife and I have 6 children. So this kind of brings up the question, what is a large family? I think the answer to that question changes with location, with time, and even with the people that you ask. And I'd like to return to that question a little bit later on what constitutes a large family. One of the things that has triggered my interest in this topic is a number of articles in recent years that talk about the effect that falling birth rates in the U.S. and around the world in certain demographics have on our culture and society. So I'm going to read a few quotes from some of these articles. Philip Longman is the author of a book called The Empty Cradle, and he has published a number of articles on this topic. He says, "What's the difference between Seattle and Salt Lake City? There are many differences, of course, but here's one you might not know." Of course, we probably do know this, but many people don't. In Seattle, there are nearly 45% more dogs than children. In Salt Lake City, there are nearly 19% more kids than dogs. This curious fact might at first seem trivial, but it reflects a much broader and little-noticed demographic trend that has deep implications for the future of global culture and politics. It's not that people in a progressive city such as Seattle are so much fonder of dogs than are people in a conservative city such as Salt Lake City. It's that progressives are so much less likely to have children. It's a pattern found throughout the world, and it augurs a far more conservative future, one in which patriarchy and other traditional values make a comeback, if only by default. Childlessness and small families are increasingly the norm today among progressive secularists. As a consequence, an increasing share of all children born into the world are descended from a share of the population whose conservative values have led them to raise large families. Today, fertility correlates strongly with a wide range of political, cultural, and religious attitudes. In the USA, for example, 47% of people who attend church weekly say their ideal family size is three or more children. By contrast, 27% of those who seldom attend church want that many kids. So he kind of lays the case out for us here in an article that's entitled The Liberal Baby Bust. Now, some of the studies that I'm going to cite deal primarily with political differences. Many of them centered around the elections of 2000 and 2004 and looked at the correlation between conservative votes and liberal votes with marriage and family size and fertility. And I recognize that there is a difference between political conservatism and religious conservatism. However, there is also a strong case to be made that I will get to, that there is an analogous religious conservatism that is closely associated with larger families. And that's certainly been my own experience in the church. I'd like to cite just a couple more statistics from some of these studies. Bush in 2000 carried the 19 states with the highest fertility, and this is controlled for racial factors. So the highest white fertility in both 2000 and 2004, he carried the 19 states with the highest fertility rates, and 25 out of the top 26. Kerry won in 2004, won the 16 states at the bottom of the list. That's a very interesting statistic. There is another article entitled Republicans' Fertile Future that has these things to say. This is was written in the San Francisco Chronicle in 2006. Over the past three decades, conservatives have been procreating more than liberals, continuing to seed the future with their genes by filling bassinets coast to coast with tiny future Republicans of America. But wait, you may say. The attitudes of the parents don't determine what ideology or political party their offspring will adopt as their own, yet they usually do. Political scientists have long found that four out of five people with a party preference grow up to vote the way their parents voted. In fact, while many people experience a temporary rejection of their parents' politics in very early adulthood, virtually nothing is more predictive of your political ideology than that of your parents. It's more of a determining factor than income, education, or any other societal yardstick. And we may ask ourselves, is this also true in a religious sense? One of the factors that people talk about, because this obviously, trying to assess what factors contribute to birth rates is a very, very complex topic. There are economic factors, there are social factors, there are religious factors, there are educational factors, political factors, you know, incentives or disincentives by various governments relating to birth rates. One of the things that is pointed out is also that not only are liberals generally having fewer children, they are also having them later, which means that over time, the generation gap between conservatives and their children will be much smaller than that between liberals and their children, which means that there will be more generations of conservatives who will likely then again have more offspring, more conservative children growing up. And this is also shown historically that right now there are nearly a quarter of the children of baby boomers descend from only 11% of baby boomer women who had four or more children, and this continues. This trend continues. Philip Longman again in another article entitled "The Return of Patriarchy." Says this dynamic helps explain, for example, the gradual drift of American culture away from secular individualism and toward religious fundamentalism. Um, Now, I think that in some senses we see a similar sort of drift in recent decades in the LDS Church. Since the 50s, I think we have seen the church drift toward more conservative stances than it did in the past, and I think part of this can be attributed to the fact that conservatives generally tend to have more children. So why is this the case? What are some factors why liberals may have fewer children? I think that there are a number of possible reasons for this. Environmental concerns is certainly one aspect. Concerns about patriarchy and gender roles. There's also an interesting tension within liberalism itself between individualism and an emphasis on free choice of the individual and a sort of a communitarian approach to things. And I think the combination of those can also lead to a lower inclination to have large families. In addition, there are some studies that have suggested that there are negative consequences to having large families. Some studies have indicated that children in large families are less happy, they have lower IQs, are less likely to succeed in school, and more likely to be maladjusted. And some of those studies may also have an effect. One interesting note, in the December 1982 issue of Sunstone, there was a review of a book called Living in the Shoe, Life in Large Families, which noted that these studies that indicated the negative consequences often reflect the fact that family size is strongly correlated with poverty. And when these factors were controlled for, there were some very interesting differences in the results of the study. So, my choice here is to make a case from a liberal perspective for large families, counter to these general tendencies to have smaller families. So why might a liberal Mormon choose to have a large family? I think one of the reasons is this communitarian emphasis in liberalism. A family is really a microcosm of a community, of Zion. And this is where we get our first lessons in how to build a larger Zion in society at large. A small family may offer fewer opportunities to learn those lessons, both for the parents and for the children. A second reason why relates to an argument that Eugene England made in his famous essay, Why the Church is as True as the Gospel. In this essay, England argues that grappling with challenges and contradictions is an excellent way for us to develop Christ-like attributes. He writes, I believe the church is the best medium, apart from marriage, which it much resembles in this respect, for grappling constructively with the oppositions of existence. And then he quotes a Catholic theologian named Michael Novak. He quotes Novak, who is talking about marriage, and invites us to substitute the church for marriage. Marriage, or the church, is an assault upon the lonely atomic ego. Marriage is a threat to the solitary individual. Marriage does impose grueling, humbling, baffling, and frustrating responsibilities. Yet, if one supposes that precisely such things are the preconditions for all true liberation, marriage is not the enemy of moral development in adults. Quite the opposite. Being married and having children has impressed on my mind certain lessons for whose learning I cannot help being grateful. Most are lessons of difficulty and duress. Most of what I am forced to learn about myself is not pleasant. My dignity as a human being depends perhaps more on what sort of husband and parent I am than on any professional work I am called on to do. My bonds to my family hold me back from many sorts of opportunities, and my wife even more so. And yet, these do not feel like bonds. They are, I know, my liberation. They force me to be a different sort of human being in a way in which I want and need to be. Now, England uses this, then, to make an analogy for the church. England does not talk in his essay about having children. My experience is that having children increases these opportunities to develop Christ-like attributes. And that's true both for the parents and for the children themselves. A child who has no siblings has fewer opportunities to develop, to be required to develop these kinds of attributes. Another reason, and this is in response very much to the studies and articles that talk about the political implications, is that we have a greater chance of passing on our values to our children than we do of passing them on to strangers, particularly strangers who are already adults, because they have already formed many of their opinions and are less flexible. These values would include such things as liberal approaches to generals. Our marriage can provide a model for our children. In fact, studies have shown that children's marriages, when they grow to be adults, strongly resemble the marriage of their parents. So we can model those approaches to gender roles in a way that our children will then absorb and take with them. We can model environmental values. We can teach our children the value of taking care of the environment. We can give them examples of scriptural interpretation. How do we read the scriptures? And how does that color the way that we view the church and the world? We can model social attitudes and teach them how to think about race relations, gay issues, feminism, and so forth, all of the difficult social issues of the day. We can show examples of loyal descent and show to our children how it is possible to remain active, faithful in the church without needing to toe the line on every issue. We can teach them the importance of critical thinking. All of these things are much easier to do with children than with others. I think another reason why some liberals may desire to have a larger family is that it also expands the opportunity for the parents to exercise a priestly role in the home. And particularly this is the case for the mother. The church quietly sanctions a woman blessing her children in the absence of her husband, or even with her husband, depending on your local church leaders. Having children, more children may offer more opportunities for a couple to exercise this priestly role in their home. And in doing so, I think we also gain a greater understanding of why the family is the basis of the restored gospel and what that means. And finally, this being able to teach our children and then send them out into the world prepared in a different way gives us the opportunity to have a greater influence on the church and in the world. My children interact with other people's children in the settings where the other children's parents are not there. And they have an effect on how other children view the world and the church. The study that was, the book that was reviewed in the December 1982 Sunstone, Living in the Shoe, after controlling for poverty factors, also found some other interesting benefits to having large families. Much of this was anecdotal, that was given as a survey to the mothers of large families, meaning families with seven or more children. And their response was that large families are more fun, and secondly, large families provide a superior environment. Several of the mothers came from one or two child families and felt as though they had been deprived. And I know many people who have expressed similar kinds of feelings. Children in large families have ready-made playmates. They often learn more coping skills. They learn to earn their own way. And they learn patience and sharing more readily than do children from small families. Part-time jobs for older children help with economic problems as well as teaching the children financial responsibility. That's not to say that having a large family is without considerable challenges. There's a great story of a bricklayer whose wife was complaining about her never-ending task of washing, cleaning, and cooking for their many children. And he says, "Well, that's true, honey, but I do the same thing, laying bricks, you know, every day. It's the same old, same old." And she responded, "Yeah, but then nobody comes and knocks down your wall at the end of the day." So obviously there are tremendous challenges with a large family. But the authors of this book conclude that despite the challenges, which include economic constraints, lack of privacy, needing more solitude, not having adult company, and of course the struggle of maintaining a household, the women report generally that they are satisfied, happy, and they find meaning in their life. Now, this obviously will vary from individual to individual, but a study such as this provides some very interesting possibilities for where we might find satisfaction in our lives. So what might be some of the objections to having a large family from a liberal perspective? Obviously, there is the objection of overpopulation and environmental resources. How do we address this objection? One way to address it is simply to think about the way that we live and live by the things that we believe in terms of our environmental values. That we maybe take a look at the American lifestyle and contrast it with lifestyles in other parts of the world. In some places in Europe where they're forced to be more frugal with their space. We also can influence our children to conserve and recycle. And also, our economic privilege relative to the rest of the world may provide additional opportunities for children who grow up with environmental values to provide, to develop new solutions that we haven't seen yet. Of course, another answer to this is to adopt. We're not there then producing more children, but we gain some of the advantages of a large family by adopting. Obviously, this can be very challenging. It's economically quite expensive. There are challenges in finding matches with adoptions and so forth. And I'll return to that a little bit in a moment. Another objection would be the divided parental attention and divided economic resources. So what might be a response to this? My response would be this is not necessarily a bad thing. This actually is one of the areas that provides us with opportunities for growth. Boredom has been identified as an important catalyst for creativity. Having more children means that they are less likely to be spoiled. They are less likely to grow up with a selfish attitude. They are forced to deal with each other, which prepares them well for dealing with other people in the outside world. Another objection would be the perpetuation of gender stereotypes. It's a current reality that may be changed in the future, but we don't know, that women are the only ones who can have children. And this is a long and arduous process, both pre- and post-delivery. And it affects her ability significantly to participate in many other activities, which can tend to perpetuate these gender stereotypes. Patriarchy is strongly correlated with high birth rates. However, I would suggest that this is not essential to a large family. It is one of the influencing factors, but the relationship of the parents and the deliberate choice to have a large family rather than feeling pressured to do so can go a long way toward mitigating this problem. So I want to return briefly to the question of adoption. The question here is essentially, can we gain all of the same benefits of a large family through adoption that we can through procreation. There was an interesting study that was done and published in 2005, reported in the New York Times, that says some politics may be etched in the genes. A team of political scientists argues, based on this study, that people's gut-level reaction to issues like the death penalty, taxes, and abortion is strongly influenced by genetic inheritance. This research builds on a series of studies that indicate that people's general approach to social issues, more conservative or more progressive, is influenced by genes. This is a very interesting idea, that our genes affect our general attitudes, and this would seem to apply religiously as well as politically. It is not that opinions on specific issues are written into a person's DNA. Rather, genes prime people to respond cautiously or openly to the mores of a social group. And this is based on a study of twins that are, you know, controlled for environmental factors as well. So this suggests that maybe there might be something after all to the idea of a believing blood, or other genetic factors that predispose us to certain approaches to the world. And this would suggest that we likely cannot gain all of the benefits of a large family that is achieved through procreation by adopting. This is certainly not an argument against adoption. It's merely an indication that depending on how we choose to approach things, our benefit, we may have different benefits. So much of this is dealt with the politics. The question is, how does this affect us in terms of our relationship with the church and our children's influence on the church? I indicated my observation that over the last several decades, the church has shifted toward more conservative views on things, and my presumption that this could be connected or correlated with birth rates among various demographics within the church. There was another study that entitled Death by Secularism that controls for factors in the world, looking at birth rates in the world, that controls for factors such as wealth. And I just wanted to read a quick quote from that. Examining the causes of population change has frustrated statisticians for years. Many factors influence fertility, including urbanization and literacy. Subsistence farmers view children as cheap labor and a source of wealth. People who remember a high infant mortality have more children. Uneducated people do not plan the size of families, and impoverished people cannot afford the means to do so. Having found no academic research that specifically measures the impact of religious belief on fertility, controlling for these factors, I've done some calculations of my own using a cross-section of data for 174 countries. My analysis, preliminary as it is, supports the conclusion that religious belief strongly influences fertility after controlling for wealth and education. And one interesting thing to note is that while education is a strong correlating factor in the world and in the U.S. for lower birth rates, LDS studies among the LDS have shown actually an opposite correlation, that more educated members of the LDS church are likely to have larger families, have a higher birth rate than the less educated members, which is a very interesting point. So this analysis passes the first cut, the test of rigor, for showing that religious belief is correlated. And this would suggest then that our religious beliefs as liberal Mormons can be passed on to our children, and that if we choose to have a larger family, that will in the long run have an impact on the church and on society at large. So I'd like to return again to that question, then: what constitutes a large family? And essentially, I think the answer to that can be found in a talk from Dallin H. Oaks in the November or October 1993 General Conference. He's entitled The Great Plan of Happiness. He says, "How many children should a couple have? All they can care for. Of course, to care for children means more than simply giving them life. Children must be loved, nurtured, taught, fed, clothed, housed, and well started in their capacities to be good parents themselves." I would suggest that this would be the definition of a large family, is all the children that you can care for, which of course will differ from place to place and from situation to situation. So, are these my reasons for having what passes for a large family today? In part, yes. I do want to pass on the things that I value to my children and to influence society through them, as well as develop the characteristics that I can achieve through home life. But the greatest reason for having a large family is one that is not reproducible, and that is my own experiences. Last week, I attended my 11-year-old son's first scout camp with him. And he was so thrilled to have his dad come with him, and I was so thrilled to see him so excited about learning new skills. We came back from camp to have my 6-year-old run out of the house and say, "Dad, I gotta show you something." And he showed me that he had learned to ride his two-wheeler without training wheels. My little daughter, who is 18 months old, is starting to talk and learning new words every day. These kinds of experiences are the ones that really make the difference for me in why I have a large family. I have found that the words of the prophets ring true for me, that the greatest joy that I have is found in my home with my children. Thank you.
I want to thank Christopher for an interesting and provocative presentation and introduce our respondent, who we're delighted is here. This is Bill Hansen, who is an attorney, which I believe qualifies him to opine on anything, and also a father of 7 children, which gives him expertise in the area at hand.
Having come from a family of 6 children and my wife Lisa, who's here with us, and I having had 7 children, I've learned to keep much of my opining to myself. I appreciate Christopher tackling a very daring subject. This is very interesting. First time I've heard somebody tackle this. And it called to mind several things right off the bat. One of the reasons that, or criticisms that members of the church came under, and probably still do come under, has to do with the relationship between large families and birth defects. The hypothesis is that because church leaders encourage mothers to have babies and larger families well into their 40s, that the incidence of various birth defects and various markers is more pronounced in a Mormon population than in other populations. That became a focus of a study that I did as an undergraduate at Brigham Young University under the tutelage of my mentor, Bob Sigmiller, and we were right next to Dwayne Jeffries, who I hope you'll have the opportunity to listen to during these presentations. We took on that subject, and for the first time, we did what was called a demographic study, we meaning I, went around to all of the hospitals and worked with John Brockert, who is the director of human resources for the state of Utah. And we went through 10 years of birth certificates and coded them with all of the ICDA codes, traveled all over the state, and came up with a statistically significant population so that we could look at the question, do Mormon families have a larger number of birth defects as a result of family size? Those results ended up being published in 1978 in the International Journal of Teratology under congenital malformations in Utah. The results were very interesting. There are two basically homogeneous Caucasian populations in the world that have religious backgrounds, homogeneous religious backgrounds. One is in Jerusalem and the other is in Utah. And we were able to show, and the reason it attracted international attention was because of the homogeneous Caucasian population, we were able to show that there is no difference in the birth defects. Mormon families do not differ significantly at all from the national averages for any of the birth defects markers, whether it's Down syndrome A or B, or any of the facial abnormalities, limb abnormalities, or any of the other birth defects. And it basically laid to rest the speculation that pursuing the larger family would result in some kind of a genetic catastrophe. It doesn't. It's safe to have a larger family. The next thing that came to my mind as I read about Christopher's thesis was the presentation and writing that Mary Beth Raines, who you'll see occasionally here as a presenter and a responder, did with regard to sexuality among Mormon couples, and particularly Mormon women. It turns out that she noted a correlation between spiritual development and progress in Mormon women and sexual progress, that the two, spiritual development and sexual development, are actually correlated. Yet another reason to support having larger families with the type of spiritual values and spiritual development that occurs in a liberal Mormon home. So both of those are interesting supports that really do support Christopher's thesis that perhaps we ought to take a look at the assumptions that are made about family size and enjoy some of our larger families. All the children that you can take care of. I thought that was a good definition. One of the things that happened in our family probably about a year ago, and coincidentally Christopher's thesis brought this to mind as well, was a concern that we had where we ask our children, now that you've grown up in a large Mormon family, how do you feel about it? What does it mean to be a Hansen, for example? And so spontaneously our children wrote down a few things. I'd like to share some of those with you. I won't elaborate on all seven children's points of view. We'd be here another hour. But I can point to some of them. This is what some of our children said. Here's what it means to be a Hansen. Being a Hansen means you feel understood, being unconditionally accepted, loved, never judged, valued for your contribution to the family, to have a well-rounded musical diet from Schubert to Ladysmith Black Mambazo, learning things first at home so you can be strong outside. It means you're listened to. You're expected to rise to your fullest potential. You have to play or enjoy watching at least one sport. You have to play at least two musical instruments. We still dream of being in a Hansen family band. Learning to accept and love diverse personalities, having inherent intelligence, it's in the genes, an appreciation for classic cars, randomness. You may make up your own jokes. You still quote movies from the 80s, family dinners, family home evenings, open-mindedness, well-read, literate, and I might say enjoy The Simpsons. One of our younger children said, to be happy and friendly, to be musical, to have a good singing voice, to go to church on Sunday, to pay tithing, if you're a boy being a flirt, naturally attracting girls, to get good grades, to be an honor student, to know how to fix food, especially meat, to love each other, to be free to do what you enjoy doing, to be close to your parents, to have social skills, to enjoy reading, to have a good sense of humor. One of our daughters said the following. To have a tremendously long teenage geek phase. To have a permanent place in the Spring Creek Ward choir no matter how long you've been moved out of the house. If you're a girl, to be at least one family's favorite babysitter. To have fond memories associated with Mingao, which is a food that we fix. To know who Waldo Wimp is, stories that we tell in the family. And the girl in the pumpkin with the marbles, another story. To feel like you're friends with all of your siblings. To have the mindset that if you're going to buy something, buy a good one so you never have to think about it again. Another one said, well, that's all I'll share with you right now. The point is that I think this addresses the intangibles that Christopher was trying to talk about and elaborated on about the blessings of being in a larger family. There are those things which, to quote the title of a book by Bushman recently about the prophet Joseph Smith, who was also a member of a fairly large family, you become a rough stone rolling, and you have the opportunity to get some of your edges knocked off physically, emotionally, spiritually. You get a chance to try out ideas and have an opportunity for those ideas to actually gel and develop in a setting where, under loving circumstances, make love the rule of the day so that you are not berated or brought down. Your reputation isn't tarnished for having an unusual idea. Anyway, those are some of the things that Christopher's thesis brought to my mind, and I appreciated the opportunity to comment on those. I would like to know from Christopher if he intends to pursue any further studies about this and what he believes the next steps are in pursuing this particular idea.
That's a great question. Given that I don't have much formal training, I don't know a whole lot further that I can go at this point. I am certainly still interested in the topic. One of the things that I think I would like to do moving forward with this topic is to see
do some more research into either studies that have been done or things that might be possible, particularly within the LDS Church, and to see if my impression from my own experiences of the correlation between conservative views and family size holds true, and to what extent larger liberal families have influence on their church surroundings, how they influence the wards that they're in and the stakes that they're in, and what that might bode for the future.
Can I ask you one other question? A lot of... Okay. Thanks. I hope you don't mind me directing a few comments back toward you. A lot of the evangelical Christian churches right now are experimenting with what they call small group interaction. They take a small number of families and have those families interact more intimately than a general congregation in terms of their family life and pursuing their religious values and other types of things, and they're trying to see what the effect of small group interaction is on the church, on congregations and things. Would you feel about something like that in the Mormon setting, and how does that interact with your idea about larger families?
Actually, it's interesting that you would bring that up. Our ward is starting something similar to that within our neighborhoods of getting small groups of families together to do things together in a primarily social setting, but one that invites a church context where appropriate. I recently had an encounter with another family in our ward who read Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling, and the husband of the family was very bothered by some of the things that he learned for the first time in that book. And I spent, my wife and I went and spent several hours at their home kind of helping them work through to a little bit some of these issues and helping them to see that there was another family who was aware of these things, who was enthusiastically active and participating in the church, who still had a testimony of the gospel. Our children interact with their children in primary. They play together in the street. The fact that my children grow up aware of challenges in church history and so forth, I think offers them a great opportunity to be an influence on other families in the neighborhood. So I think that this really does provide a lot of opportunity to improve the interactions in our neighborhoods and in our wards and church setting.
We have just about 10 minutes for questions. I'm going to move this out into the aisle so that you can ask yours.
Chris, in your studies, were you able to determine or get an idea regarding whether low birth rates among liberals is something new? And if not, why liberals exist in any great numbers at all today?
I don't know exactly what you mean by new, but considering the fact that modern reproductive control is significantly better than it has been throughout the course of history, it would seem to me that this would be a relatively new phenomenon. There were a couple of studies that talked about some of the other world events that influence birth rates. For example, after the end of World War II, right, baby boomers. Because of the problems of war, the consequence shortly thereafter was a huge explosion in birth rate. And I think really most of the way that we would have to answer that question would be pretty much after that point in time. However, on the other hand, the article that I cited called The Return of Patriarchy Also took a brief look at the rise of Christianity in the history of the world, and also the effect of the Roman Empire on the world. And one of the interesting things that it noted was that one of the great factors in the rise of Christianity was a greater birth rate among Christians during the course of the Middle Ages and prior to that than their pagan counterparts, which I don't know all of the details of the study on that, but seems a very interesting point to that. So my suspicion is that it's a relatively new phenomenon, primarily because of the availability of birth control that is effective.
Hi, I was really interested in your thesis, particularly because of an audiobook I was listening to just recently. It's why people believe weird things. The author in this particular part where I am right now, he's talking about acceptance of or origination of more radical scientific ideas. And a very strong positive correlation between the birth order and acceptance or origination of these radical ideas, and suggesting that the decreasing number of birth order is strongly correlated with staying with a more conservative, at least views from at least a scientific standpoint. But there seems to be a bit of a dichotomy. From both when you think of a Mormon family, you think of a big family, or the stereotypical for more Orthodox Catholic families, no birth control, big family. But that seems to be a dichotomy between the more religious family, bigger, and more theoretically more conservative, they're more religious. And this idea that I was reading about with the larger family being more accepting and more originating of more radical ideas. Just if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's very interesting. So if I understand correctly, later children in larger families tend to be more open to more radical beliefs, less conservative beliefs. Is that right? That's very interesting. That would be certainly another case in favor, another point in favor of the case from a liberal perspective of having a large family, because not only do you pass on your genes and your values through the environment, but also apparently you provide more of an opportunity for the later children to have more openness. That's very interesting.
Somewhat predictably, I want to push you on the question of cost for mothers. You talk about it in terms of perpetuating gender stereotypes, and that's kind of a problem, but I don't think that really gets at it. I mean, there are real opportunity costs for a woman who decides to have a large family, and balancing those things out, I think, is a really important consideration, because not all liberal Mormon women will want to have large families, I think. And so how do you...
I completely agree. One of the real challenges, I think, that we have in the church for women is the pressure to have a large family. As I have spoken with my extended family members, a very common theme for women is they never feel like they have had enough children, because they feel the pressure from the church to continue having children until it's no longer safe to do so. And that is a real problem, because it introduces a real tension between, or a real confusion in trying to understand whether the large family is something that they do by their own choice, by their own desires, or because of the pressure that they feel from outside. I think this is where we have to really think about what is the definition of a large family again. And all you can care for needs to take into consideration the desires of the mother. In fact, I would say that's the primary consideration. I think the fact that that studies suggest that the opportunity costs are offset by the benefits are something to take into consideration as well. And it certainly is a challenge. That's probably the most challenging aspect of this. One possibility may be that as technology develops, that that opportunity cost can be shared between men and women. We don't know yet. We don't have that kind of technology available yet. You know, movies like Twins aside, but if that does happen, then those opportunity costs could be shared better between men and women. That might be something for us to pursue and to think about.
It occurs to me to share an experience with you on this. I hadn't thought to do this before, but I have a large family, 7 children, a daughter and 6 sons, all grown. But I had a tragedy occur in our family about a little over 10 years ago, where one of my sons committed suicide. And up to that time, my family had become fractured because of my controversial experience in the church and several divorces. So I had family, children from 3 different mothers. So I had come to the conclusion that my family was pretty dysfunctional because of those pressures. But when that happened, all my children, including their mothers, came from all over the country together to where we were. And it was, for me, a miracle, because it was astonishing to me to see that everyone knew what to do. We didn't need anybody's help, any church help or any other psychological help or anything. Somehow, everybody knew what to do instinctively. The conflicts and the problems that we'd had with each other melted with that kind of a gathering. And we spent a miraculous, a very sorrowful but happy and amazing week together, healing wounds and dysfunctions and misunderstandings and coming together in a remarkable way. It couldn't have happened without the community of that family.
Thanks. I think that's a really great illustration of the support system that a large family can provide as well. And that touches on another interesting point. In some of the studies of worldwide birth rates, one of the interesting correlations that was pointed out is that suicide rates are higher in areas where birth rates are lower, which is another very interesting point, and I think may relate to the fact that there's a lack of a really good family support system to help.
Thank you, Christopher and Bill, for your remarks, and all of you for your good listening and provocative questions. This session is over, and you can go to the next one. Thank you.